Season 4, Episode 20 of the Canucks Speakeasy Podcast. I'm Pete. Doug, we're kind of getting back in the groove here. It's only a two-game flight, so let's jump into it.
The Canucks found themselves hosting the Ottawa Senators on Saturday night and came away with a dominant 5-2 victory. Standouts from this game was the fourth line, especially Nils Amon with a goal and an assist, and Dakota Joshua with two assists. And of course, everyone's current favorite Canuck, Andre Kuzmenko, had two goals.
Canucks end their six-game homestand with another 5-2 victory, this time against the Dallas Stars, the aforementioned fan favorite that people wait in line for, Andre Kuzmenko with yet another goal. Guillaume Brisebois with his first NHL goal. Congrats, Guillaume. Well-deserved on a beautiful play by Nils Amon. Brock Besser with a strong game as well. Three helpers. Connor Garland, a couple of helpers as well. And birthday boy JT Miller, a goal and an assist. An all-around good effort and an all-around good homestand, Doug. I mean, the Canucks have won five in a row and they've made some signings. Like, what's going on here, man?
Yeah, clearly, I think Demko coming back is, in my opinion, the biggest difference maker. I think Tocchet is, you know, the structure and the accountability that the players seem to be having since Tocchet has come on has definitely been noticed. But I think it's Thatcher Demko. Like, he seems to be the biggest difference maker right now for this team. And I know a lot of the tankists and draftists are a little bit upset, myself maybe included, you know, about slipping farther and farther out of the Connor Bedard sweepstakes. Not that we probably ever had a chance of actually getting him. But for me, it's David Reinbacher season. You know, right shot defenseman. He's the guy that if the Canucks slip outside of the top 10, top 15 maybe, or not 15, let's say top 12, Reinbacher's the guy that I hope they're going for. But I mean, again, we've seen this script before. We saw it last year with the Boudreaux bump and the team seemingly getting all the everything in line to have a strong start at the beginning of this year, and that clearly wasn't the case. So I think a lot of fans are fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or no, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And I think that's why a lot of fans are a little bit skeptical about the recent
I think fans have every right to be skeptical. Now, look, I'm always a glass half full fan. You know that. And it does feel different this time. Maybe that's just my naivety. I don't know, but it does feel, from what I'm seeing on the ice, it does feel a little different. And maybe, you know, you mentioned Thatcher Demko, and Demko now is very different from Demko we saw at the start of the year. And I mean, it also begs the question, is if you had this Demko all season and you're getting the goaltending, where would the Canucks be? And you look at the start of the year, I don't think anyone really thought that the Canucks were going to be in the Connor Bedard conversation. I think maybe some people did, but I think the majority of Canucks fans thought we'd be closer to the playoffs than closer to the bottom of the league. And of course, that didn't turn out. And of course, here we are right now. But I look at the teams that are below the Canucks in the standings, and I do believe that the Canucks are better than those teams. Now, remember, as long as the Canucks finish in the bottom 11, which it looks like they are, they still get a lottery pick and they get a shot at Bedard. And the difference between where the Canucks were before this five-game winning streak and where they are now is the difference between a 7.5% shot at getting Bedard and a 6% shot. So we're talking a 1.5% difference. And yeah, okay, we're going the wrong way in those Bedard odds. But really, it's kind of negligible. And, you know, I think a lot of what we're seeing right now is just entertaining hockey. You know, we both talked about Kuzmenko and what he's doing right now. For me, this is just kind of a welcome respite. But, I mean, the deja vu factor is very real from this team. We've seen this before. Boudreaux bump, Tocchet bump. Go on a winning streak at the end of the season. Have a soft schedule at the end of the season. The Canucks have the second easiest schedule of any team left in the NHL. So you know that with where the way they're playing right now, they're going to continue to probably climb up the standings a little bit more. But I think every Canucks fan has seen this script before. Am I naive for thinking it feels a little different this time? Maybe. Only time will tell. And really, we're not going to get that answer until probably November or so next year.
Yeah, I think a couple of the things that make me feel a little bit different about this recent push late in the season is Tockett himself has come out and said he doesn't really care about getting the wins. He's like, look, the wins are nice, but he's like, it's more about building structure and having guys kind of step up and become leaders. And, you know, I think it was last night's game, post game, he made comments about Quinn Hughes and how Quinn Hughes has become very vocal and like really shown some really good leadership skills since he's come in the dressing room. Obviously JT Miller is JT Miller. He seems like a guy that's not afraid to speak his mind, but he said even Petey is being a lot more outspoken and saying stuff. And you even see some of these young call-ups from the AHL, like Christian Wolanin, who seems to be very vocal on the ice, directing traffic to guys. And I think that's something that we've heard from former players of this team in the past, mm-hmm. is that it's a very quiet dressing room. We heard that from Jason Dickinson when he left.
Nate Schmidt?
Nick Schmaltz. Nate Schmidt, that's it. But yeah, Schmidt's another guy who, you know, said it's a pretty quiet team. And I think you're seeing these guys kind of be given that opportunity to step up and take leadership roles. And I know when after they traded Horvat, that was one of the first things Tockett said. He said, we need other guys to step up and assume a leadership role of this team. And he even said when he first got here, it was very quiet. And we're kind of seeing that narrative change a little, which I think is good. And then just quickly going back to the draft lottery, I believe it was officially announced today, Pete, May 8th at 4 p.m. will be 4 p.m. Vancouver time will be the official draft lottery. So, get your hopes ready to be crushed, Canuck fans, because you know we're not getting Bedard. But like I said, if we can get a guy like David Reinbacher,
I think he's going to go top 10. Not Bedard, but yeah, I mean, Bedard as well. But I think he's actually going to go top 10. All right, I'm just making a note here. May 8th afternoon. Put Twitter on mute. Okay, done.
Are you going to be in Europe at that time still? Yeah, I'll be around.
Okay, so cool. I'll be partaking in all that madness. Who am I kidding? I'll be right there front and center laughing at all of us. Hey, one other thing, you mentioned Christian Wolanin. The Canucks are winning on this winning streak with a bottom four defenseman, I guess you could say, consisting of Kyle Burrows, Guillaume Brisebois, Noah Juulsen, and Christian Wolanin, who combined for a $3 million cap hit and proven to be fairly effective. I think all four of those guys, you know, I knocked Juulsen a little bit last episode saying I hadn't seen a lot from him. I think he's actually had a couple of very solid games. I know he got in a fight as well. Kyle Burrows has quietly been getting stuff done and hitting out there. But having those four guys as your blue liners, we still haven't seen Hronek. Don't know when we're going to yet, but he's eventually going to slip in. And the Canucks are doing this with those four in a starting six, which is essentially an AHL four at the start of the season. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And I think it speaks to a couple of things. I think Jeremy Colliton down with the Abbotsford Canucks deserves a ton of credit because it seems like he's really made an impact this year on the Abbotsford Canucks and just the way they play structurally. And that seems to have transitioned up to the big club for these guys that are playing with the Canucks now, the big Canucks, we'll call it. Wolanin is a guy that I do really think if there is a spot available for him, he could be an everyday NHLer heading into next year. Yeah, I really like his poise. He's still leading the Abbotsford Canucks in points this year as a defenseman. He was on the AHL All-Star team. He's having a magnificent season. It's nice to see that also carry over to the NHL. And, you know, Guillaume Brisebois, I believe we talked about him signing an extension last episode, scored his first career goal in the NHL. It was an absolute beauty of a goal, too, for your first career goal for an NHL defenseman. It was an absolutely gorgeous goal. I forget who it was on Twitter. I wish I could give him credit, but someone was saying he's actually the longest tenured Canuck games played to go to score his first goal. I think it was like however many or days since drafted. I think it was like over 2000 or 2100 days drafted, I believe is what it was from when he scored his first NHL goal. It was a cool little stat there. I think it was Rob the Hockey Guy is the guy who tweeted that out there. So that was really cool. Really happy for Guillaume Brisebois. And like you said, I agreed with your take on Noah Juulsen last episode, Pete. He looked okay. I didn't think he looked great, but the last couple of games, he's definitely looked more comfortable. He's been a lot more physical out there. Like you said, he got into a fight last night after laying a pretty big body check on Glenn Denning. And yeah, if you were to tell me that this team would be going on a 5-game winning streak, I believe it is, up to this point, with that bottom four defense, I would think you were absolutely
Christian Lennon,
crazy.
I know we talked about it before as well. 27, I think a lot of people forget that he's 27 years old and he's a UFA at the end of this year. Kyle Burrows in the exact same boat, 27 and a UFA. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with those guys. Juulsen is an RFA out of there, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. Another guy to kind of watch right now, Jet Wu, who's been really picked up his game down in Abbotsford. He is RFA. And of course, you have Philip Johansson, who's expected to come over. And of course, Jack Rathbone. So as good as Willannon and Burrows are playing, I think it's still going to be very hard to squeeze them in, because all it's going to take is one team to come over the top with an offer getting closer to a million. And both are one of those guys could be gone. At least that's my take. I mean, they're very serviceable, but it's going to be hard to keep everyone and keep everyone happy. But again, this is a nice problem to have, and it's nice to see these guys contributing. And speaking of signings, we actually had a couple in Vancouver this week. The Canucks finally I shouldn't say it like that, because they're at the mercy of the NCAA, but finally, for a lot of Canucks fans, get Aiden McDonough locked up, and they also lock up the pizza man, Phil DiGiuseppe, for a couple more years. Again, the DiGiuseppe contract is pretty much exactly the same from a cap perspective as the Guillaume Brisebois one. So again, you're getting some effective, low-cost players in there who are going to be playing above their cap hit at the rate they're going. DiGiuseppe as well, don't forget, he's 29. He's been around for a while, so you're getting a nice veteran presence there. But Aiden McDonough will be joining the team here. We're going to get a look at him at some point. Kind of in an interesting situation, because he's not eligible to play for Abbotsford because of just the situation that he's in. So he's going to be up with the Canucks, getting some games in along the way here. We're going to get to see what we have with Aiden McDonough in some capacity here. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you draft a 7th-round player and you end up feeling like they deserve an NHL contract, which is what Aiden McDonough got, that's a huge win for your organization. I'm still going to temper my expectations for McDonough long-term. But again, you have a 7th-round pick who's essentially hit. He looks to be a potential NHL player, or at least an actual prospect, and not a guy of a name you pull out of a hat and, magically hope he'll become a player. This guy seems to be a player. He's got some work to do. His skating definitely seems like it's a bit of an issue. He's very well spoken in a couple of the interviews I saw with him post-signing with the Canucks. He knows he needs to work on his skating. He's also indicated, look, he's never going to be a burner out there. That's not the type of player he is. That's not his role. But he's got a very heavy shot. I think he's a big net fronts, big body presence on the power play. And if you could free him up for his big shot on the power play, this guy could potentially pot, I would say 12 to 18 goals on your third line in a few years from now. That's kind of my prediction with McDonough as the top end ceiling for
He's finished exactly a point-a-game player as well with his time at Northeastern. 124 points in 124 games. That's pretty impressive. Has had a very strong career there. Got better every year, comes over now as a 23-year-old. Because of the way those NCAA contracts are structured and because of when he signed it, he's got to be up with the big club. So at least he'll get to hang around and get a taste. Whether he's on the big club next year to start the year in Abbotsford, who knows? But this is something we've seen before, is burning that entry-level year and coming up to just get you in there and get you onto the roster. It's nice for him, and that's kind of what you have to do as a guy who's 23 coming over. So what he does the year after that, who knows, but he's under contract, whether he plays up in Abbey or with Vancouver, and he's on one of those 10.2C deals, so that means that the Canucks still have control of him in some capacity after that as well.
Yeah, and the other thing I will say about Aiden McDonough and why I'm a little bit more hopeful from some previous college players drafted or free agents signed by the Canucks is this regime seems to be putting way more of an emphasis on development and not rushing guys to the NHL. Adam Gaudette, you know, was a great selection for a fifth round pick. He really was. But he was absolutely rushed to the NHL. And I think that did suffer and hurt his development long term. And we're seeing that now. Was he ever going to be the guy that we all thought he was? Probably not. But I do think if he hadn't been rushed to the NHL by the previous management group and the previous coaching staff, I do think he would probably have been able to carve himself out more of an everyday role in the NHL as a third or fourth line center. And I do think that even though McDonough is going to get a long look at the end of this year, get to practice with the big club, potentially get some games in, I'm sure he's going to play a handful of games. It'd be crazy not to. I do think heading into next year, they're going to let him simmer and actually properly develop down in the AHL. The other thing, Aiden McDonough's best friend growing up was Jack Rathbone. They are best friends. And so Rathbone, there, you heard some rumors from, you know, some well-connected media guys that Rathbone and the Canucks haven't had great relationship the last year or so. And, you know, potentially and hopefully this is something that could hopefully mend that relationship. I know Rathbone's also been dealing with a lot of injuries the past couple of years, and that's kind of deterred some of his progression as becoming an everyday NHL player. But at the end of the day, this is a win. And I do think that this management group will take their time with players like Aiden McDonough and not try to force them into the
NHL.
I'm
not saying with these next names that the Canucks rushed these guys, but it's more just it's a sign that we do often overvalue players or guys just don't work out. And the trio I'm thinking of right now is when we lost Joni Gadjevich, Cole Lind, and Tyler Madden all in a fairly quick succession. And it felt like, oh, geez, our prospect pipeline is dying here. Out of those guys, the only guy who actually has played some games in the NHL this year is Joni Gadjevich. He's played 35 games with the Sharks. He has 3 goals and 4 assists. But Cole Lind hasn't played an NHL game yet this year, and Tyler Madden is yet to play an NHL game overall. So not everyone pans out, and you need more of these guys to have more of a chance. So again, temper expectations with Aiden McDonough. I think that's good. I'm doing the same, and I think they'll ease him in, and we'll see a couple of games out of him, and maybe we'll get excited by it. But there's no reason to think that he's going to be gifted a spot in the lineup next year. But the Canucks have a glut of forwards and wingers. You know, we're not even talking about Nils Höglander and Ilya Mikheyev, and if Tanner Pearson comes back, he's another body. I'm not sure if he will, but the Canucks have a lot of forwards. It's going to be hyper competitive. And Phil DiGiuseppe, the other guy that signed this week, is also going to be in there in a depth capacity. And I like what I've seen from DiGiuseppe. I think he's been very versatile playing between the second and fourth lines. And he really can't complain about a guy with a cap hit like that. He's $750,000 this year. His new deal, just like Brisebois, is $775,000 cap hit for 2 more years.
Yeah. And again, this is kind of cliche to say, but he is a Rick Tocchet type of player. He's a meat and potatoes type of guy. He's a guy that is a good penalty killer. He takes pride in his penalty killing. He's got a bit of an offensive flair to him. Like, he scored a really nice tip-in goal. Was it last night's goal where Kuzmenko found him right in front of the net for that tip-in? Really nice goal, or maybe it was JT Miller that found him. I would actually maybe heading into next year, I think a fourth line of Dakota Joshua, Nils Amon, and Phil DiGiuseppe could be a really impactful fourth line for this team. I know both Joshua and DiGiuseppe kind of play the left wing, so one of them would have to move over to the right, but I think that could be a pretty, you know, useful fourth line for the Canucks heading into next year, depending, obviously, injuries, offseason acquisitions, signings, all that stuff. But that'd be something I'd be potentially looking for heading into next year. And this is apparently his first multi-year contract in his career. Like you said, Pete, he's 29 years old. This is the first time he's had a contract.
And
over
that would give him at least 3 years, assuming, you know, he doesn't get traded or picked up on waivers or something in the same area. That's probably for him. That's a big bonus as well. I mean, he's got 3 goals and 2 assists in 14 games, but like you said, he's been useful. He's been killing penalties. I like that idea of a fourth line. I was talking to some other guys about this, but I think Nils Åman personally is kind of the perfect fourth line center in this day and age with just the way he's progressed this year and what we're seeing out of him. And I think that time down in Abbotsford has done really well, but I think you come back next year with Nils Åman as your fourth line center. That's perfect. I don't think he's a 3C. I think he's a 4C. I think what the Canucks do at 3C is for the 2000th year in a row, still kind of up for grabs and up for debate. I don't know, but I think Åman with that, with Joshua and DiGiuseppe, very useful fourth line. And again, all those guys can kind of move up and down the lineup a little bit as well. I think that'd be great to see. I mean, we know Joshua is going to be back. We know DiGiuseppe's going to be in the mix as well. And we know Amon's going to be back. So, I mean, they're really all kind of on show me deals. They're all on cheap deals next year. I mean, none of those guys are making over $1 million next year. None of them are making over $900,000 next year. So, I mean, you talk about getting some cost effectiveness there with a fourth line. All those guys are bringing it.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think heading into this coming off season, I think one of the biggest targets for this team is actually going to be to try to find a third line center. I think more so than the defense. Obviously, they acquired Hronek. We still haven't seen him play yet, as you alluded to. And the group of AHL players that they've been able to manage to play these last handful of games in the bottom four pairing have been very, very good and adequate. But they really need to find that third line, legitimate third line center, a guy who can go out and win over 50% of the faceoffs, take key faceoffs in the defensive zone, and potentially, you know, score 15, 20 goals in a season. And they haven't had that since a guy like Manny Malhotra, in my mind. And I think that's going to probably be one of their number one idea, like looking to add to this team, is going to be a legitimate third line center. Whether that's a veteran guy that they signed to a short-term contract, well, a guy like Atu Ratu marinates in the AHL for another year, I think that's going to be their number one priority this offseason.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think a 3C and still another top two right side D, those are obviously the two holes that the Canucks have. And can they plug that internally? Are there guys within the organization that can step into those roles? The 3C, I'm not so sure about right now. Well, really, I'm not so sure about either one. But then how do you address that? Is it free agency? Well, the Canucks right now, they're kind of capped out. So you got to think they're making some trades at some point anyways. But, you know, kind of looking through just some of the top available guys at center. And, I mean, I'm not saying the Canucks could get any of these guys. But, you know, Ryan O'Reilly is going to be out there. A guy like Sean Monahan is out there. Now, these are all kind of older guys. I mean, I don't think they're going to be able to get a guy like Pierre-Luc Dubois, but that's kind of exactly what they need, really. I mean, JT Compher, that's another name that kind of jumps out at me, but I don't know if there's a guy, any of those guys are the right fit and are going to come in at a price that the Canucks can manage. I mean, free agency is generally when teams overpay, and Canucks fans know this. I would prefer to see them, and again, any sort of guy like that they bring in is over that threshold, that window of 21 to 26 or 22 to 25 or whatever we're talking about now. All those guys are outside of that, and I think that's, to me, makes it myself think that the Canucks are going to go more the trade avenue. And then when you say, well, what do they have for assets to give up? We kind of come back to some of the guys who've been playing better as of late, Brock Besser and Connor Garland, and what do you do with maybe those guys? I don't want to see them start emptying out and trading a whole bunch of draft picks by any means, especially their first. I really want them to keep their first this year. The Canucks actually do have 7 picks in the draft this year, which is great to see. So that's kind of, for me, I always want you to, when your team is not a contender, I want you to have at least 7 picks in the draft. But for me, it's I see them going after that more via trade than free agency, and I'm not quite sure exactly where we're going to go. It's going to be an exciting offseason.
Yeah, I could see it being like maybe a quote-unquote bad contract for bad contract. A guy that I think, and again, I'm not saying this guy is a long-term solution or a guy that I would necessarily want, but an Alex Kerfoot is a guy that I could see.
Oh, Alex Kerfoot.
Maybe being able to acquire.
Oh, every trade, Alex Kerfoot.
I know. And again, not my option, but, you know, I think he could be a serviceable third line guy. And, you know, maybe you trade one of your wingers for him. It's a bit of a net neutral acquisition for the team, but you're giving up a position that you're relatively deep in on the wing for a position that you don't have a ton of depth with at center. So that'd be a name I would throw out there, but I'm sure there's some other veterans out there that you could look at for signing. The other issue is this team is to the cap. They're maxed out to the cap again. And you're unable to take advantage of teams trying to shed salary, right? And when you have that cap flexibility, there are teams who are trying to shed salary to make a big splash over here or to add a free agent over there. And you can get players that are of high value for sometimes pennies on the dollar. I look at, obviously, Christian Ehrhoff when the Canucks acquired him. And when you're capped out like the Canucks are and you don't have, you know, you're not a playoff team, it really hurts you. And I think that is one disadvantage they're going to have heading into the offseason, that they're going to have to either cough up more assets to free up cap space with some of the bad contracts, quote unquote, or they're going to have to trade a good player for a good player, which, again, you know, if you're trading from a position of strength to a position of weakness, that's a good thing. But right now, this team's main position of strength is the wing, and the NHL as a whole, the value of wingers seems to be pretty low.
First, Alex Kerfoot is UFA, like most of Toronto, it seems, at the end of this year. So, I mean, you wouldn't have to give up for anything. The other option with getting rid of players is the buyout route. And I don't really want to get into that in this episode because we could be here for a long time. But I think the buyout is very much an option in Vancouver's case with some regards. Doug, we've also we got Brendan coming up on this episode as well. We got a segment Jabbering with Jabo coming back after Brendan took a couple weeks off there. And we got a bunch more Canucks chat. But Doug, how's things, man? Before we get into all that round two of Canucks stuff, how's life?
I mean, you know, I've definitely been better. I had two wisdom teeth pulled out of my mouth last week. So I'm okay. I'm in a little bit of pain still. Hopefully I'm not mumbling or drooling too much during the recording of this episode. But other than that, you know, I've been okay. Got my antibiotics and some T3s to kind of ease the pain. What about you, Pete? How's your week been?
It's been all right. Nothing too crazy over here. Just been pretty much doing the same routine. I don't have anything too eventful to report right now. It's just kind of that time of year where I enjoy just kind of coming home and it not being pitch dark when I look out my windows right now. And so I've just been kind of getting some spring cleaning and shit done around here. And, you know, I go away next month for a couple weeks. So starting to get some stuff together for that, which is always kind of fun. I always enjoy the planning for a trip and the booking of, you know, internal flights and trains and hotels and all that stuff and figuring out where I'm going to eat and drink. That's always my favorite part. So just a whole bunch of that kind of stuff right now. But yeah, overall, things are all right now. Hopefully this episode is going to be all right, too, because it is being a fun couple weeks or a teeth-gnashing couple of weeks, depending on what sort of Canucks fan you are. You can also follow us on the interweb on Twitter. I'm at Pete_Gass, and the podcast also has an account, and that is at Canucks Speak.
You can give me a follow on Twitter at Doug Venn. And be sure to check out the playlist on Spotify. It's the Canucks Speakeasy Outro Playlist. Pete and I continue to build the playlist with the outro segment of every episode. And Pete, you edited the last episode. Why don't you tell the people and the listeners out there about the song you used?
Yeah, so I've had this one in the back pocket for a little while. I used an edited version of it, just it's a little bit shorter for the outro. But on our playlist is the full length 8-minute version of the song. It's called Do Yourself Some Good. It's by a group called Uncle with a K. Now, if you don't know Uncle, Uncle is been around for a long ass time, but kind of comes and goes over the years. It's a project by a fella named James Lavelle, who's been around the music industry for a long time. But he's had, like, the reason I found out about it is because DJ Shadow was involved in the first incarnation of it. And he's worked with a whole bunch of different people, from Tom York to Mike D to, you know, Michael Kiwanuka on this new album of his. So the track is from the album called Ronin. And it's an incredible album. I really recommend listening to it. And I also, like, it's one of those ones where you got to listen to the whole thing, because it starts off very dark and moody and old school trip hop, which is kind of what Uncle started as. And you're like, oh yeah, okay, I've heard this before. But what I think is really brilliant about this album is it kind of comes out of the trip hop into, like, a little bit more soulful stuff, kind of like you're waking up. And then you kind of get into some of these funkier tracks, like that we used there, the Do Yourself Some Good. And then it kind of gets a little more and builds and builds and almost like a little more housey and electro towards the end of it. So I think it's an incredibly fantastic album. I'm very excited because I'm actually seeing Uncle while I'm in London as part of this one-day festival. And he's doing this album start to finish live. He's doing this Ronin album from start to end. And I'm very excited about checking that out.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I remember Uncle from the late 90s, the album Science Fiction. Yeah. I really like that album. I know he did a really cool collaboration with Tom York. I believe the song's called Rabbit in Your Headlights. And yeah, to be honest, I hadn't really listened to any Uncle in quite a few years. But yeah, you used it in the last episode and I really liked it. I thought it was a really, really, really cool track. And I definitely want to check out the rest of the album. And I think that's super cool. You're actually going to get to see him perform the album in its entirety.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing one-day festival thing in London, but that was one of the highlights for me, was seeing Uncle. James Lavelle is also doing a solo, or I think he's doing a back-to-back DJ set with someone else. I got to double-check that, but he's also doing something else at this one. But and it's a great album, but again, it's an album I think you got to listen to the whole thing of. Like, don't, like, just turn it off after the first track. It's like, oh, I've, you know, mellow down tempo trip hop, because it changes, it keeps you engaged. I really do recommend just, you know, putting it on and giving it the whole thing, because it's a builder. And for me, someone who's a fan of a lot of different styles of music, including electronic music, I think the really good albums tell a story and take you on a journey, and not just electronic, but good albums take you on a journey, and this one really does. All right, Doug. Let's bring Brendan in. We haven't had him for a while, and let's get into our Jabberin' with Jabo.
Just a bit outside. So it's been around a month or so since I've been on the show with a segment, and of course a lot has happened, both on the ice and off the ice. I'm going to focus on the ice. I mean, I think for those people that follow me on Twitter, those people who were following me on my Facebook days, will know that, you know, I bring up the S word a lot in the past few years, past 5 years, really, and that being structure. What I was seeing from other teams with rosters that I didn't feel that were that much better than the one that Vancouver had, to, you know, even with their deficiencies that they obviously have. And what I wasn't seeing here, whether it was Travis Green as the head coach or Bruce Boudreau as the head coach. And certainly now's not the time to be doing any victory laps, because, I mean, this team has a long way to go. They haven't really proven anything outside of the fact that they can play better defensively, which no one's happier to see that than I am. You know, I've mentioned a few times in the last few weeks zone coverage in the defensive end. And, you know, if when you're playing a sport, like any professional sport, you know, whether it be in the NFL or the CFL or the NHL or the NBA. I mean, a zone scheme, there's a reason for it. And when you're going up against the best players in the world, the fastest, the most athletic, the most talented, it's very hard as a defender to cover somebody man-to-man. And the amount of communication you need to make that work, I mean, it's difficult. Whereas playing a zone scheme, you know, we've seen it so far with the Canucks, it does make a difference. It makes things easier. You're not asked to defend a Connor McDavid, although they haven't played McDavid in the last while, but you're not forced to chase after the best players in the world. You're asked to cover your zone. You're asked to take that area and fight for it aggressively. It's allowed them to be more compact. I mean, they're not giving up as many seam passes as they were. I mean, it isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly far better than what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, where, I mean, seam passes were just, I mean, alleys were opening up, gaping alley seam passes were just, it was ridiculous. And so to see that now, see that change, it for me is really a major positive. And one thing that you come out of that zone scheme is it makes your outlet passes easier. It makes them more predictable because you know where your players are going to be. That right, like let's give an example here. Say you're playing man to man, and your right winger is chasing, and that puck is turned over in the right corner, that right D. Unless there's proper communication and proper rotation, that defenseman has no one to pass the puck to. And how many times did we see that in the last few years, where that defenseman has no one to pass the puck to? And so he will either hold on to it, double clutch, and have the forecheck get in on him, or he'll put the puck into a space where there's no one. Often. Too often. And I've said it a few times. Like, people, we watch the defense and we see that pass go to a spot and there's no one there. And the knee-jerk reaction is go, well, what the hell is the defenseman doing? And you can almost guarantee that there was supposed to be someone there. That they expected it, and it wasn't. And usually because players are chasing. And chasing causes chaos. Chaos causes players to try to do too much and try to compensate. And that's where you end up really, really struggling to keep those seams closed. Whereas, you know, when you're playing a zone scheme, you really are focused, and really it's been fantastic to watch, because as you defend better, I mean, like what I explained this on Twitter earlier, the difference between Boudreaux and Tocchet. You know, Boudreaux was quite open. He believes that the best defense is a good offense. That you create by being aggressive, by keeping your foot on the gas and not letting it go. Well, and there's nothing wrong with that if your team plays structurally sound, which this team doesn't. And so Tocchet comes in and very much. I don't want to say he's the next coming of Elaine Vigneault, you know, in this city, but certainly there are similarities in that Tocchet's belief is that if you play well defensively, if you stick to that process, you play together as a five-man unit and trust each other, that other team is going to give you opportunities. And we've seen it. I mean, the fourth goal against Dallas, Brisbois' very first goal in the NHL, created in the third period, which I thought was a very good third period for the Canucks in terms of how they played structurally. They stayed tight. They stayed compact. They created a turnover. That turnover led to an odd man rush. That odd man rush led to a goal. You know, I've been saying it for a few years now. When you have a lead in the third period, you don't have to do anything. You've done your job. You have the lead. And if you play the right way and do things properly, that other team is going to have to overcommit. They are going to have to get aggressive. They are going to have to pinch defensemen. They're going to have to do things they may not want to do, but they have to because they're behind. And that's when good teams pounce. That's when teams that know how to hold leads, that's when they capitalize. And that's where that team, or that's where the Canucks capitalized against Dallas. You took that chance, and you made them pay for overcommitting, for pinching defensemen, for being too aggressive. Under Boudreau, I mean, they didn't have another gear. It was always had to be full throttle offense. They didn't know how to dial it back and play proper structural defense. And we're starting to see the building blocks of playing well defensively. It doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, I'll say this. Playing well right now doesn't guarantee that this team will come into next season playing well any more than what's happened in years past guarantees that this team won't be successful. You know, it's up to these guys to decide who they want to be. And if they continue to play this way, they continue to upgrade the roster, which you're assuming they're going to do. They're going to be more moves. You're going to be integrating players into a system that players trust. And that, to me, is as important as anything. We've seen guys come in here, the Dickinsons of the world, that come in here and don't look comfortable. And, you know, it's as important as anything to get that changed, because a high draft pick isn't going to change that. What's going to change that is this team committing to a system, trusting that process, and playing the right way. I mean, all those cliches we hear, I mean, they're cliches for a reason, because they're right. We'll see. I mean, obviously this team's playing well. I'm not focused on wins or losses. I'm focused on how they are playing, because that's going to be as important as anything else. And it just so happens that the way they're playing is leading to wins. And you know what? I'm not going to begrudge that. I would much rather see them play well and win than not play well, not learn these lessons and lose. Because if that happens, no matter who they draft, isn't going to help them. This team has to figure out how to play together. And you know what? I'm quite happy to see what I'm seeing right now. As I'm sure some of you are, and I know some of you probably aren't. I'll be back soon. I won't make it a month. We got to keep talking about this team because we're coming towards the end of the season. Around a month to go. So we'll see where it all goes, and we'll talk soon.
All right, thanks, Brandon. Brandon and the S word, structure. You know, I think we one time when we were out with him, I was joking we should make it a drinking game that every time he says structure, we all got to take a sip of beer. But then I realized I don't think we needed any further help with that project. But I do think, one thing that he said as well that is about the roster and how teams with rosters that on paper appear weaker than ours had more structure. And that was something that was very frustrating to watch for quite a few number of years. Now, again, like people, the critics are going to argue this is the effect of the Tocchet bump. And you know what? It could be. I'm not going to completely put my neck out there and say, no, this is completely different. But I will say that what we have seen structurally, defensively, man-to-man, all these things that Brandon talked about, it does feel different. Like that for me, there are definitely aspects of the Canucks breakout game and their zone coverage that I haven't seen in a long time.
Well, and again, yes, I'm skeptical too about whether or not this is going to be able to sustain into next year. But I think one of the bigger differences that we've actually seen with this club in comparison to Travis Green, Bruce Boudreau, and you know, maybe even going as far back as Willie Desjardins, is Tocchet is very much a fundamentals coach and very much, again, using the S word, a structures coach. And I think Green he wanted a run and gun. Obviously, Boudreau was definitely a run and gun type of guy. Willie Desjardins wasn't, I wouldn't say he was a run and gun type of coach, but you know, he kind of balanced on both sides of defense and offense. And again, all of those three coaches, in my opinion, seemed to play with more feeling of how the game was going and how the flow of the game was happening in front of them, as opposed to what Tocchet has said since he's been hired, is like, we're going to have rules in place. The rule is, if you get the puck on this side of the boards and it's however many minutes into your shift, you're just going to dump it down the ice and get off the ice or whatever. You know what I mean? If you get the puck, you're not going to blindly make a pass behind you. You're going to wait a second, analyze the situation, and then try to find the open man. And I think we've seen that more. And the other thing, the players seem to be buying into that. It's fun putting up points and scoring heaps of goals and getting all those, padding your stats and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, I think these players want to win games. And I think if they are committed to buying into what Tocchet has been preaching, especially heading into next year, I do think that this team will be a playoff team. And I feel like I say this every freaking year. And every year I look like an idiot. I believe I projected this team at the beginning of the year for 105 points. Laugh at me, point at me, all you want, ridicule me. I don't care. But I do think with Tocchet and the players seemingly buying in to committing to playing a defensive style of game and waiting for those offensive opportunities to appear, I do think this team, obviously health is an issue as well, can be a playoff team next year. But they have to have a good start once the new season starts next year. They can't come out of the gate 0-6 or 0-8 like they have the last couple of years.
That's it, right? I mean, we're all going to be pins and needles for those first couple games. The worst thing that could really happen is the Canucks start even 0-2. It would be kind of a disastrous. I mean, I know it's an 82 game season, but if the Canucks came out of the gate 0-2, everyone's just going to be like, "Oh Jesus, here we fucking go again." A good start next year is so paramount. That also ties into having a good training camp. There was rumblings that management was unhappy with the Canucks training camp this year, and also like I never thought like you know. Watching the Canucks play and what Tocchet's doing, it's really low event hockey, a lot of it, right? Like it's not stuff that you get excited about, but it's nice to actually see because we haven't seen a lot of these things. You know, you mentioned the blind passes or the no-look passes. Those are significantly down. They are not doing those. They're not panicking, and the way they're breaking out is much more noticeable. And that's little stuff, and it's low event hockey, but what I've seen and what I've heard other people comment on as well is that, you know, certainly under Boudreaux, the Canucks were offensive first. We're going to score our way out of any problems. That's some old school 80s hockey mentality right there. That works some nights and it's fun to watch. And Bruce Boudreaux's an awesome guy. We all love Bruce, but it doesn't, In this current NHL, it doesn't guarantee you long-term success. You hear it in every sport, defense wins championships. Whatever one of the big four sports you talk about here in North America, it works across all of them. Pitching and defense in baseball, team zone defense in the NBA, a great defensive line and secondary in the NFL, and in hockey as well. It starts with defense. And if you're playing defense and you're playing smart, you're going to get your chances. And that's more where the shift has come in Vancouver. And the Canucks do have enough firepower to make it work. But what's great to see is guys like JT Miller is a good example, and Connor Garland is another good example of guys who are generally considered more offensive players, but have defensively over the last month or two become much sounder and better players overall.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, especially on the defense wins championship thing. I think, like you said, across the board, that is generally a narrative that rings true more often than not. I do also think when you're playing that run and gun style and you're coughing up 30 plus shots a night on your goalie, that wears your goalie out, man. Like your goalie, and we saw that last year down the stretch, even though Demko was playing so well, you know, he ended up getting injured because he had a bit of an injury heading into training camp. And then he just looked tired at the beginning of the season of this year. He looked kind of tired, and maybe that was injury related. Maybe it was just, you know, the amount of games and shots he was facing down the stretch last year. But I believe last night's game against the Stars, I believe they held the Stars to 20 shots or just under 20 shots or just over 20 shots, which for this team and for as good of the Dallas Stars have been this year, especially offensively, that's a pretty impressive number. And I do think that, yeah, you're scoring goals. It's more entertaining for the fans, but it does come at a cost. And sometimes that is your goaltending. It's your defenseman running around trying to chase the puck instead of standing there structurally sound, committing, you know, their bodies to blocking shots and stuff like that. I mean, we've seen JT Miller block a couple of shots since Tocchet's arrived. It's been great, man. And I am cautiously optimistic that this team and the success they're having at the end of this year can potentially carry over to next year. I think Hronek, I do think he's going to make a pretty big impact on this team once he's healthy. And I think we're going to really see that impact heading into next year. Obviously, he's hurt. There's only a handful of games left. I think there's, 12 or 14 games left for the Canucks. So we're not going to see a ton from Hronek. I'm sure they want to get him a couple of games and get him acclimated with the rest of the team. But I am very excited to see what potentially is going to happen with this team heading into next year.
16 games left for the Canucks, Doug. We got 16 to go still here. You know, talk about goalies and getting tired out. That six-game homestand, Thatcher Demko, five games, 181 goals against, a .937 save percentage, and a 4-1 record. Now, that's Thatcher Demko that we know. And, you know, when we do our three stars at the end of the month, we've had no goalie points this year. Thatcher Demko all of a sudden is making a push for maybe we're going to see Thatcher Demko get on the board for our Golden Barfly Award here. He's having a solid month. And Arthur Seelofs with the other start, even 279 goals against, .906 save percentage, and the win. That's great for a backup when you have a guy like Thatcher Demko in front of you. Goaltending is key. And look, Spencer Martin, he was brought in to be more of a backup. Colin Delia was more of a depth guy. And when you're running with those two guys and the Canucks just defensively are not helping out there, it was a tough scene overall. I bet you if Spencer Martin came back and we saw him get a start down the stretch here, I think it would be a lot better. I don't think Martin and Delia, obviously that's not a tandem that's going to win you a lot of games, but it was... The defense is a team game, and the Canucks weren't buying into that. And so the numbers reflect that. One thing that I noticed, and Demko did make a couple of great saves against Dallas last night, but a lot of the shots are just getting eaten up in the breadbasket. You know what I mean? Like they're going, there's a lot of great positioning, and that is partially as well because they're keeping the lanes clear. And there's a lot more of that, like letting the goalie have the sight lines and letting the shots come from the perimeter. And that's the way I like teams to play defense. And so I'm always quite noticeable. It's like, where do you want the other team to shoot? You want them to shoot from the Ovechkin spots. Really, you do. Is you want to push those shots outside. Not everyone is an Alex Ovechkin, but you kind of want to push them around more to the perimeter, because not only then is it, you give more of the angle for the goalie, but you also, it's harder to hit the net. There's the chance of it missing, which, as you know, is one of my biggest peeves on a power play. When you're taking that shot, I hate to see them shoot it from that angle and have it whip around the boards and go out the other way. Like for me, that's a low percentage shot a lot of the time. And the Canucks have been pushing more and more out there and keeping the front of the net clear. And that reflects in the numbers for the goalies as well. And I mean, Thatcher Demko, though, has been playing like Thatcher Demko. And this was not the Thatcher Demko we saw. And is that a team defense thing? Is that a fatigue thing? Is that an injury thing at the start? I think it's probably a combination of all of those. But what we're seeing now from Thatcher Demko is extremely different from what we saw from early season Thatcher Demko.
Yeah, and I think just Demko's rebound control is just so much more noticeably better than Spencer Martin or Colin Delia's. Even if there is a big rebound, Demko knows to kind of direct it towards the corner. So the rebound isn't going straight back out front of the net towards another shooter. He's kind of directing it off to the side. So maybe your defenseman can pick it up, or it bounces off the boards and, you know, you're not giving an open shot immediately back to the opposing team. And he just looks so much calm out there. And the team, I think it also gives the team in front of him more confidence, having a goalie back there that can make those big saves. Because, you know, when the Canucks were giving up all those third period leads when they were up two goals heading into the third, and they would end up having three goals scored against. And sure, some of those games, Thatcher Demko was in net, but you just know the psyche of that team heading into the third period with a two-goal lead was, oh shit, can we please save this? Can we please hold on to this lead? Because you just know that the other team's going to make a big push and probably score at least two goals to tie it up and potentially win it in overtime or the shootout. And you just have that confidence with Demko back there where you can go into that third period. We saw it last night against the Dallas Stars. The Stars made it a one-goal game. It was 3-2 before Guillaume Brisebois scored his first goal of the year. Even the Ottawa game, Ottawa made a bit of a push late, and the Canucks held on and ended up scoring more goals. And I really think it's just having that confidence that you have a goalie back there that can bail you out when the other team starts to push. Because every game, it's a tug of war, right? Every game, generally speaking, both teams are going to have, whether it's 10 minutes of push, a full period or two of push, you know, both teams are going to have a solid push back. And knowing that you have a guy that can stand there and hold you strong and hold the team steady to that push back and not give up that back-breaking goal is such a confidence builder for this team. And I think we're seeing that in the results lately.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. It's something I was thinking about with the Ottawa game when Ottawa made it 4-2. And I thought, oh, okay, you know, before we would just kind of expect the crumble, and it didn't feel like there was that crumble happening this time around. It's great to see. And again, all this, I know it's a lot of people are saying meaningless wins, and I get that. But this is all about building on to next season. I still think the Canucks are going to have a low percentage lottery pick, which really they were going to have anywhere that they were right now. But I think for what we've seen so far, though, that I do understand why people get frustrated with it. But the Canucks currently sit eighth worst in the NHL right now, which gives them a 6% chance at the first overall pick. They were sixth worst in the NHL. That was, like I said, a 7.5%. But really, you could be fourth worst where the Ducks are right now, and that's a 9.5% chance. Like, are you going to get down to where the Ducks are? No, the Canucks are 9 points ahead of Anaheim. They're not going to get that low. Really, I think the lowest the Canucks could get is fifth worst, where Philly is right now. But that's only an 8.5%. Are the Canucks going to get up to where Detroit is, which is 10th worst in the league? I don't think so. I think that you're looking at Vancouver. You're looking between kind of that fifth worst spot and that ninth worst spot. And the Canucks are currently in the eighth worst spot. And that your range of getting first overall is between 5 and 8.5% in there. And I don't, you know, that's a pretty negligible difference. Yeah, it's a difference. But I mean, I think that's just the reality of where we are. I'm not losing a lot of sleep over it. I never expected us to really have a good shot at Bedard anyways. And I think for me, this is about building and moving forward. I just hope they do keep their first round pick, wherever they finish next year or with this year. Sorry, I do hope that they do that. The Canucks have by far and away out of the teams out of the playoffs right now. It's them and Nashville that have the best record over their last 10 games as well at 7-2-1.
Yeah, it's funny. Nashville sold at the deadline, and yet they've been on a bit of a heater lately. I believe they're 5-2-1 in their last 8 games, and yeah, they've been one of the hottest teams in the league. And again, Nashville is another perfect example, kind of like the Canucks. When you have a player like UC Saros backstopping your team, they, you know, and the goalie is on, it is such a difference maker. And I know people are disappointed that all these meaningless wins are coming at the end of the season, but Demko coming back, you had to know that they were going to win games here. It wasn't going to be when we had Delia and Martin. They were going to win games. And it was, you had to expect that. Obviously, with a little bit more structure and a new coaching philosophy and change, that we're going to start to see some results from there. And whether or not that can be sustained, that seems to be the topic and word of this episode. But I do think heading into next year, if everything goes how it looks like it should go and the teams show up training camp ready, committed, I do think we could see this team being a playoff team next year. And I'm excited, man. Like, yeah, I get disappointed. I know you get disappointed, Pete. You're definitely, generally speaking, a lot more optimistic of a fan than I am. But I love this team. And even when they're being really shitty and they're making mistake after mistake and signing bad contract after bad contract or making head-scratching trades, I still love this fucking team. And I'm always going to love this team. Maybe I'm sadistic, but I love this team. And I know you do too, Pete. We went to the 2011 Stanley Cup Finals and saw the fucking Boston Bruins steal the Stanley Cup from us in our home barn. And you know what? We both stood there, cheered, clapped our hands, and, you know, tipped our caps to this team because we fucking love them, man. Yep. And yeah, you know what? I do think that this team one day is going to get over the hump. It is going to break our way. You know, and I hate being that Canuck fan, the sad Canuck fan. Oh, everyone against us. Bad luck. Canucks luck. We never win the fucking draft lottery. We never get this. But one day it is going to break our way. It really is.
Yeah, I just hope I'm around to see that. Also of note, the Islanders pick looks more and more like it's going to get turned over to Detroit this year, just with the way things are. And you say you're not a crazy person, Doug, but right now as it's gotten darker as we're recording, all I can see is your head right now. It's like a full black background. It's you kind of do look like a crazy man and a crazy fan. But yeah, I'm with you, man. I mean, you know, 2011 is a good example. Like you said, we stayed there. I mean, so we were also in the building for the Slay the Dragon and the Stanchion, like just some incredible moments. But I can't actively cheer against this team. I mean, I know if we lose these days, it's like, all right, well, we lost. It's easier to manage because, you know, overall it's better for the team. But I can't actively cheer against them. Oh, Doug just turned on the lights. He no longer looks like a Funkadelic album cover or something anymore. Doug, before we take it into the free pour here, I just wanted to touch a little bit about the media. And there's been a lot of conversations about the media in Vancouver. And it seems to, like, for me, like, this is just my take, it seems kind of bizarre that it's another divide in the Canucks fan bases is to having views or being critical about the media. And so where I'm going with this is I think it's always a good thing to be critical of media, no matter what we're talking about, whether it's world events, whether it's sports. Like one thing that I do a lot of the time when I like to read the news every morning, but I'll go to different sites and read it. I'll read like BBC, I'll read CNN, I'll go to Al Jazeera, I'll go to the CBC. And I use all that to kind of get an idea of what's going on. And I think with media here as well, I think it's okay to be critical of media. If I disagree with something a media member says, though, that doesn't mean that I disagree with everything they say. It just means I disagree with that. And I don't see anything that is wrong with that at all. I know there's certainly some more polarizing members of the Canucks media, but just because I disagree with something or a take by someone, that doesn't mean I disagree with everything they say. And I think that's something that a lot of Canucks fans now just have ingrained kind of in our heads, because we turn on each other so quickly, and the media is kind of like the latest barometer. And I think the whole Benning bro, bitter bro thing really stoked that fire further and further. But, you know, I know a few media members follow this podcast. I don't know if they listen to this podcast on the regular. I don't know if they've made it to this moment in here. But look, I think it's okay to be critical of media and to question. And if you don't like something they say, hey, that's fine. Be respectful, call out. Don't ever like tell people they should get fired or any shit like that. But I can think of quite a few media members. Yeah, I don't agree with everything they do, but then they'll write something or say something. I'm like, yeah, I do agree with that. It's not something that it should be completely divisive, but I do encourage people, yeah, be critical, question, do that with all media, not just the media on your favorite hockey team. That's kind of my rant, Doug. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, look, you and I don't agree on everything, right? And I think that makes for a more engaging and more enjoyable listening experience, at least in my opinion. We hope, exactly. Again, for me, I agree. Look, I think you should be critical of the media. And just like, you know, I could be critical of an opinion you have about the Canucks or an opinion that Brendan has of the Canucks or whoever. It doesn't matter that they're media. My issue is just when, and it goes both ways, it's not just the media that does this. There's fans that do this too.
Yes.
But it's when people talk down to each other about their opinion. And it's like they're acting like they're smarter than you because their opinion is better than yours, smarter than yours, more informed than yours. And you know what? Maybe some of those opinions are more informed than mine because you are a media member, your ears to the ground, you're in the dressing room or in the scrums post-game talking to the Canucks, all that stuff. I just don't like it when media members and fans, for that, like, start talking down to one another and start, like, kind of shitting on each other for their opinions on this hockey team. I think it's bullshit. And that's kind of where I get a little bit annoyed with some of the media members in this market. And a lot of the fan base in this market is exactly like this too. And it almost becomes a tit for tat where a media member feels like they got to stick up for themselves. So they get a little bit snappy at a fan who is trying to say, oh, it's not all bad. This is good, that's good. And the media member has to kind of snap back and be like, no, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. This is why it's bad. This is why it'll continue to be bad. And that's the discourse that I don't like. I think Vancouver actually, generally speaking, has a much more engaged and informed media base than some of the other markets across Canada and across North America. I mean, I look at some of the media bias you see in Edmonton and it just makes me fucking want to stab my eyes out. I mean, it's brutal. And now I know I hate the Oilers. The Oilers are probably the most hated team in the entire NHL for me. I hate them more than the Bruins. I hate them more than the Leafs. So I could be a little bit biased there. But I do think regardless of the public discourse we see between fans and media members, especially on social media and Twitter, I actually think it's good. I actually think seeing media members engage with the fans like that is good, as long as we're being respectful to each other's opinions and thoughts and we're not talking down to one another. I think it's a good thing. I really do.
And there's a couple of things as well. Like, media has changed, and once 1040 went off the air, it changed even more in this city. Vancouver's always had a great line of a very prominent media, and you know, I go back to the Sports Page days and looking at the alumni from that's pretty incredible right there. But there is a lot out there. It's a crowded marketplace, and we're all trying to grab attention. And I say we because we're doing a podcast. I mean, I know we don't promote it shamelessly or anything. We just kind of do this for fun. But there are people out there who are trying to get eyes and ears onto them, and they have to engage more to do that. And it is great to see that people do engage out there. But I agree with what you said about the holier than thou or the higher and mighty approaches that you can see out there. And this also, like, again, goes with the fans. Often the people who defend or attack the media the most, I find, are often the ones who are the most critical of other people's opinions themselves. And I think that's very hypocritical. Like, look, it's a sports team. There's no wrong opinion. There's definitely more informed opinions, and there's probably better opinions. But if your opinion of the team is your opinion of the team, that's what makes sports and entertainment so kind of diverse and judgmental, really, I guess, for lack of a better description. Also, the players themselves are professionals, and they come under intense criticism in this market. And again, sometimes it's the same voices out there who are either defending the media or being critical of a player, or the other way around, defending a player and being critical of the media. It's the same thing. They're all professionals. This is a part of it. This is an entertainment industry. You're allowed to have your opinions on it. Other people are allowed to have their opinions on it, but yeah, just keep it respectful, folks. Like, I mean, and just because you disagree with something, but with one person, it doesn't mean you disagree with everyone. I like to try and engage with fans across the board because I want to hear what people say, and I'll engage with them until they're a dickhead. And I know there's people out there who have blocked me, and I've blocked some people too. And it's generally because a line has been crossed. And for me, though, this whole media thing, like, we have an engaging media. That's great. Don't talk down to people, please. But everyone's professionals here, and we should always be critical and analyze the information and where we're getting it from and how we absorb it.
I totally agree with you, Pete. And I think people absorb information differently and they look at certain aspects differently. And you need to respect the fact that, hey, I'm looking at this. You always said you're a glass half full type of fan. And I think there's a large majority of fans and maybe some media members that are glass half empty type of fans. And that's fine. You're allowed to cheer how you want to cheer, as long as you're not being an asshole about it to other people. Just like I'm allowed to cheer how I want to cheer if I'm not being an asshole about it.
Yeah, I agree. I just wanted to get that in there because it's really frustrating. And we're just constantly dividing ourselves in over silly things. And you know, we all have opinions and we all make mistakes. You know, we go back to, I know Dan has made fun of us a bunch for this. Dan Mackles, who's contributed to this podcast quite a bit. And he's made fun of some of our early season predictions. And we're wrong a lot of the time, too. Yeah, so what? I don't care. Like, I'm wrong a lot of the time. And don't be afraid to change your opinions. And don't be afraid to listen to people that you may not listen to and be critical of people that you sometimes aren't critical of either. I think it's very important. So anyways, I just wanted to get that in out there. And thanks to the media folk out there who have been supportive of the podcast as well. We do appreciate that. And all the fans and listeners and other podcasters and content creators as well. And with that, Doug, let's take it to the free pour.
All right, it's that time of the episode for the free pour open floor segment. And I wanted to talk about a documentary that popped up on Netflix. I believe it was last week. It's a story that I know really intrigues you, Pete. It intrigued both of us when it first initially happened. And there's probably even more questions today than answers. And that was the MH370 documentary, which is the Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 that just up and vanished back in 2014. And I didn't know what to expect heading into the documentary. You hear news reports that it seemed like, oh, the pilot did it, that he committed mass murder-suicide and crashed the plane. You heard other reports of pieces of the wreckage washing up in Madagascar and other places on the coast of Africa and stuff like that. And after watching this three-part series, I still don't know what to believe. I don't believe that the pilot committed mass suicide. I certainly don't believe that the Russians doctored this into a false flag operation because a week prior they were invading Crimea. The Indiana Jones-like character, who's the guy who seems to be finding all the wreckage on the beaches on the coast of
Madagascar,
Africa,
yeah.
Madagascar and stuff like that. I don't know to believe him if they're planted or not. But it's a very interesting story. It's a very interesting topic. I know a lot of the families are still upset that they haven't been told the entire truth of what happened. And I think a lot of them just want closure. They want to be able to say, hey, here's where the plane crashed. The bodies were here. And then they can have that closure for their family. But it's a fascinating story that I don't know if we'll ever get the answer to.
Yeah, I watched it too, man. I was hooked. It's just a crazy story that I think about often. 9 years that's been, man. I recommend that as well. And we're on a documentary kit because my free pour is also a documentary that I wanted to talk about. I finally caught on TSN recently the documentary The Grizzly Truth, which is by Kat Jamie, who also did The Finding Big Country, which I know we've talked about on previous episodes, especially when we had Cody Sweet on with us and his connection of being a Canucks fan in big country. But The Grizzly Truth, basically, so Kat is from here in Vancouver, Filipino-Canadian, and a big Grizzlies fan, and just kind of talking about trying to find out why they left and what exactly happened. And goes through, she interviews a ton of people, including guys like Steve Francis and Stu Jackson, which obviously a lot of Grizzlies fans like to throw poop at for being a huge part of the problem. I thought it was really well done. It's very eye-opening. It's very humanizing, especially to those two that I mentioned. I think it's well worth a watch for any Vancouver sports fan. Even Don Taylor's in it, which is pretty cool. But it's well worth a watch, all about the Grizzlies. I won't give too much away, but I believe it's on TSN streaming right now, so go check it out, The Grizzly Truth. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Episode 139, season 4, episode 20 is just about in the books. And Doug, I know we talked a little bit before coming on and hitting record a little bit about the NFL and the wackiness that is their free agency and silly season right now. And I'm having a tough time keeping up.
Yeah, I mean, David Montgomery just signed with the Detroit Lions. I don't know what that means for DeAndre Swift. The Patriots, Jacoby Myers left for a 3-year deal, $33 million to sign with the Raiders. And then the Patriots went and signed Juju Smith-Schuster to a 3-year deal worth $33 million. I don't know how I feel about that. Obviously, Aaron Rodgers, it seems all but confirmed he's going to become a New York Jet. Ezekiel Elliott was cut by the Dallas Cowboys, which isn't really that shocking considering how much of a season, how big of a season Tony Pollard had last year. But have you been keeping up with anything? Have the Seahawks done anything interesting?
Trying to, man. I saw Rashad Penny left. I can't remember where he went though. But Penny's no longer with the Seahawks. Seahawks have made a couple of moves. Haven't gone anything too crazy. But again, like I'm just really struggling to kind of keep up with everything right now. I saw Clowney got released as well, which I thought that was a pretty big one. I know Lazard went to the Jets, kind of helping, trying to pave the way for Aaron Rodgers over there.
Oh, and the Bears. The Bears traded out of the first overall pick
right,
to the Panthers. Yeah. That's a big one as well.
That was a big one. I know, like, just even seeing, like, you know, the Derek Carr, Jimmy G, Andy Dalton, like all the quarterbacks shuffling around a bit. But man, it's like I just pulled up a page here and I'm just scrolling through. Just,
did you mention Darren Waller so getting traded to the Giants?
No, I don't think I did. That's another one as well. But man, there's so much that's going on. It's the silly season. The NFL, I mean, for a 7-month off season, they sure like to keep you engaged and find ways to do it.
I don't know if anyone does it better than the NFL as far as keeping you engaged during their off season.
No, I mean, and they have a whole channel that every day they seem to be talking about and finding stuff and creating and creating stories. But yeah, man, it's silly season. The guys getting released. Curious to see where everyone ends up. We still haven't even gotten to the draft yet. That's going to be a lot of fun. But next week, I think maybe we'll maybe talk about some NFL in the outro. We'll see. But we got March Madness coming up. I got to fill out a bracket after this, which is me throwing darts at a board, pretty much picking schools because of names. So it's a great time of year for sports. Even though the NFL isn't on the field, it's on the airwaves, and it's a great time of year to be a sports fan. Like I said, March is the second best month in the sports calendar, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know much about college basketball, obviously, outside of the big teams, but it's always an engaging, entertaining tournament to watch. And are the Georgetown Hoyas in it this year? I don't think so.
I have no idea. I haven't looked at my brackets yet, but I basically, I don't know anything. I'm generally just picking schools because of previous tournaments, or because I like the name, or I like the city they're in. It's pretty primitive picking for me. I don't put a lot of thought into it, but I still love watching the tournament. I think the quality of basketball is awesome. I really enjoy watching it. It's going to be tough for me to watch the first few games tomorrow while I'm working, but I'm going to put the TVs on, and hopefully I can kind of catch a glimpse while I'm working around in the back of the brewery. Folks, thanks for listening to all our rants this week, and you can follow us again online. I'm on Twitter at @Beat_Gas, and if you need some beats, please check out the Canucks Speakeasy outro playlist on Spotify. All the outro tracks, including this one, get put onto there.
Be sure to give me a follow on Twitter @DougVen. Follow the podcast on Twitter @CanucksSpeak. As always, thanks for listening.
Hasta luego.